Welcome back to the Centered on Campus podcast. It's your favorite culturally specific program manager, Asia Evans with NOVA. I am here with two of my wonderful colleagues, Ava and Kim. And today our episode is titled Recognizing Military as a Culture. How can campuses support military connected survivors? Today's episode is going to be very important because we need to have a conversation about what it means to identify as a culturally specific population on campus. And so before we get started, I want to do a little bit of groundwork into understanding why we're having this conversation. And so working on the campus side of the OVW grant and with NOVA and our technical training and assistance program, one of the things that I think about is how do we define culture and what does that mean? So in our first episode, when we talked about the importance of cultural responsiveness, we focused a lot on marginalized identities in that conversation. And that conversation is needed and it's important, right? But there are also other areas and other communities on campus that exist that form cultures that have specific traditions within their own communities. So we think about student athletes. That's a culture on campus. We think about students who are affiliated with fraternity and sorority life. That is a culture on campus, right? And so one of the things that we also have to think about is our military connected students. And so for me personally, I don't have a background in the military and I don't have a lot of experience connecting with military related students. And so one of the things that I found to be very important is when we are working with these students on college campuses or we are working with college campuses that are deemed to be military friendly, what does support for those students look like on campus? Does it need to be tailored? Do they have the same access to the support and resources that non-military connected students have on campus? And so today, my two colleagues, Ava and Kim, are here to join me in this conversation about why we need to recognize military connected students as a culture and how we need to support military connected survivors and how different that might look than support for non-military connected survivors. And so I want to take a moment to allow Ava and Kim to provide us with a quick introduction on who they are and the importance of this conversation.
Thank you, Asia. And hello to everyone listening. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to learn more about this very important topic and population. My name is Dr. Ava Ramirez-Ene, and at NOVA, I am the Military Coordinated Community Response Senior Program Manager. A little bit about me, I am a retired Marine Corps veteran. I served for almost 9 years before being medically retired. And during my service, I worked on the flight line in airfield operations and later transitioned to imagery intelligence. During my service, I also worked in a secondary and voluntary billet as a uniform victim advocate for military sexual assault survivors. And throughout my service, I continued my education to obtain my master's degrees and ultimately my PhD in forensic psychology with a specialization in victimology. And my research focused on rape myths and stereotypes impacting law enforcement response and beliefs. And I also have direct service provider experience in prevention and intervention in youth and young adults.
Thank you, Ava and Asia and everybody listening. Thank you for being here. My name is Kim Henry and my pronouns are she, her, and hers. And like Ava, I work at NOVA and I'm the Military Community Coordinated Response Program Manager and have been with NOVA for not that long, but I've actually been a credentialed advocate in the Sexual Assault Victim Advocate Program since 2012 while I was serving active duty. And so my military service goes back about 10 years. I was in the Navy as a cryptologic analyst and did a lot of interesting intelligence stuff that looks cool on TV, but it really wasn't where my passion was because I was, like Ava, a sexual assault victim advocate. And that's what drove me to being a social worker. So I completed my master's at the University of Southern California with a focus on military policy and programs. And I'm licensed in the state of Texas as a social worker. And I'm happy to be here.
We are so excited to be having this conversation. I've been talking about this conversation for a minute now, just because I don't do a lot of work with military connected students. And so being able to have colleagues like y'all to just really sit down and be like, hey, can you help me understand this and really figure out how we can intersect the work that we do between the military connected side, but also the campus side. And so y'all already shared with us a little bit about your military experience, but Ava, can you talk to us a little bit more about what led you to become a survivor advocate in the military space?
Yes, thank you. So as I briefly mentioned earlier, I did serve in that voluntary role as a uniformed victim advocate for military sexual assault survivors. And it was really this experience that ignited my passion for uplifting and centering the voices of marginalized communities, such as military-connected survivors and also communities of color. Because in my experience as a military advocate, I observed and experienced firsthand some of the very challenging barriers that this culture and environment embodies that influences how victim survivors are treated and or believed, and why many of them will not report their abuse or assault. And even if they do report or seek services, they are most likely not going to go to those agencies that are military affiliated. This military structure and environment, it fosters victim blame and shame, and also denial of that individual's voice. And there is a lack of physical and psychological safety. And even just living, surviving, and fighting this system was extremely challenging as a service member and as an advocate. And to be completely honest, it wasn't until recently I had not even realized the amount of harassment and sexual harassment that I had experienced myself, because I had diminished my own experiences due to desensitization and had normalized behaviors as just part of that culture and how things were. So in saying all this, I do acknowledge that the military is taking steps in the right directions. However, I also understand there has been and always will be room for improvement. And because of that, I want to be part of the process to push for trauma-informed, victim-centered, and culturally responsive support for all victims, survivors.
Thank you for sharing that, Ava. And I think the part that I connect with the most is taking a step back and reflecting when you're in those positions to be like, wait a minute, that experience sounds familiar. And I think the thing that is so impactful about it is now that we're kind of, I'll speak for myself, being far removed from some of those experiences, being able to take a look at the bigger picture while we do this work. Kim, can you talk a little bit about what led you to become a survivor advocate?
Yeah, being in the military, you know, I joined the Navy from a small town in Kansas. And I always like to share that because where I grew up, we had, you know, Friday night football and bonfires in our small town. And that was it, you know, and I joined the Navy where there's no oceans around Kansas. And so I kind of always, you know, people joke about that. But I joined and I was extremely naive. I had no idea what I was doing. I just knew that they could give me a paycheck that was consistent. They would pay for my college and possibly I could make my brother's dependents and help them get health insurance. So a lot of different wins for me, right? And when I joined, I had this kind of perspective of I'm going to see the world. I'm going to volunteer. I'm going to save lives. And I knew I was walking into something unknown or uncharted waters, no pun intended. But some uncharted waters. And within the first year, I was in Japan during the tsunami. First year and a half, I should say, I was in Japan during the tsunami. And I found out there that I was accepted to the Naval Academy Preparatory School. And being in that environment, it was exciting and challenging. But that was my first experience with military sexual trauma, but more so the retaliation. And that was extremely difficult. And again, only being in the military for about a year and a half, 2 years, if you can imagine being 19, 20 years old, and just the whirlwind of what's happened in those 2 years, coming from a small town, you know, I talk a lot about how our brains aren't developed until we're mid 20, 25, 26 years old, and how much support is needed for survivors and also on the prevention side, of course, but how much support is needed for survivors that is not there and that wasn't available to me. I didn't have anyone to report to. I didn't have anyone to go to for support. And I just never wanted someone to experience what I had experienced, especially the level of retaliation. And so what led me to being a survivor advocate is not necessarily being the voice for others, but doing what I could to make sure to have that role to help create that platform for survivors to be able to use their voice and create that space for them. And I love doing it. And that's what led me to being a social worker in this space, in the survivor advocacy space.
Thank you for sharing that, Kim. I think that is such a profound story. And I think whenever we're listening or reading about stories when it comes to sexual violence, domestic violence, and stalking in the military connected world, I think one of the things that we hear about often is that retaliation piece. And that is what tends to get sensationalized, whether it's in the media, the way that's written in an article, or just the way that people talk about those things in relation to the military. And I know the three of us offline have had conversations about the nuances of people even respecting military connected folks or military connected survivors as a culture. And so, Ava, to kind of kick us off into the meat and potatoes of this conversation, why is it important for college campuses to recognize that military-connected students should be considered a culturally specific population on campus?
Thank you. Great question. I love to get started with this, and excuse me if I go on a little bit of a rant, but it's important for college campuses to recognize military as its own culture and requiring of specialty support and services because of the very unique aspects, challenges, and experiences for those that are connected to it and what they will face or have faced. So just to dive in a little bit, oftentimes when Kim and I present, we do ask attendees one question, which is, when you hear the word military, what comes to mind? And as I'm saying that, maybe everyone listening has already had some initial thoughts pop into your head, such as uniform, hierarchy, firearms, being tough, or deployments, even PTSD. And these are really just a small part of what can make up this culture and also what can cause some significant barriers for victim survivors. So, for example, when you join the military, you become immersed in a world that, in essence, is controlled and influenced in every aspect. And you are surrounded professionally, personally, and socially in this very close community that requires complete submission and following of orders and puts the mission and unit first over everything else. So one way this is done is through military training and indoctrination that school is to break someone down and rebuild them into a mold that fits into the system and into this environment to be able to perform the duties that are required, right? And if you can imagine, this in itself can be traumatic, but it is quote unquote successful for that warrior mindset in order to be tough, push through, not show weakness. And again, that primary importance being the military and the mission, where you are and have to be prepared to protect your fellow service members and the country, which in itself is a huge responsibility that is also structured in hierarchy with different ranks that commands that respect and obedience. And even thinking about the different ranks, not surprising, the military is male dominated. So on active duty, they're about 83% male. And this can also vary significantly depending on the branch. And although the military does encompass a variety of people from all different backgrounds, there is that majority demographic. And military-connected individuals who belong to different ethnic and cultural groups, such as people of color, women, LGBTQIA+, they're going to have different experiences. And I'm sure you can begin to imagine and understand how these dynamics can lead to very challenging barriers for victim survivors, whether that victim survivor is a service member or a dependent family member. So already we have this environment in which you are surrounded in every aspect of your life You are expected to be mentally and physically strong and to follow orders and put the military first and also go through this chain of command that is likely part of that majority demographic. So as someone who may be struggling with mental or physical health issues, or maybe who someone who experienced a victimization, or maybe you just need support and resources because you're going through something challenging, there is that fear of retaliation or being ostracized or alienated, and that fear that you could even be viewed as someone who betrayed their own unit. So a lot of different components that not only make up this culture, but also can significantly impact how victim survivors are treated. And again, maybe if they're even believed, and why many will not utilize military services, but actually go off base into the community. So for college campuses to understand this entire dynamic, this entire culture, and if military are transitioning out of this culture into another large institution, what are we doing on that campus and university and in the community to best support these survivors?
I appreciate you going off on your rant or on your tangent, because this is what we need to hear. I think that we don't often have these conversations about really breaking down the dynamics of culturally specific communities, and especially in military communities, because a lot of us who are on the outside, so as a civilian, right, I don't know what it looks like. I just hear the stories, or I see what's on TV, or I just hear some vague terms being thrown around, and I don't really know what that means. You know, like even when I had a session at our conference on kind of unpacking being Black in the advocacy world, and there were a lot of military connected folks in that space, they were talking about their experience, and I'm at the front of the room not understanding anything that they're saying, right? And it's like, oh, there's a disconnect here. And so how can I, as an employee, as an advocate, support folks who are in this space without knowing what they're going through, what they're talking about, or at least having a glimpse into what that culture looks like? And so, Kim, I want you to speak to this piece specifically. Why do civilians, and so that's non-military connected folks for our listeners, why do we need to understand this?
Well, I think Ava in her rant, you know, it's us. We just get fired up about it. We just get really worked up and fired up, and we're just very passionate about it. And that alone can answer that question. Why do civilians or those that are non-military connected, and why do they need to understand this? It's because time and time again, military connected survivors have been let down in a lot of different ways. To give you an example, to kind of open that perspective, you know, we may hear or we've experienced it ourselves, or we've seen, you know, other veterans or other military active duty service members or other forms of military connected survivors reach out to a community individual, maybe a community advocate or a healthcare provider, someone that's not within essentially a military agency or a military installation, but a civilian, someone outside this military organization. We've seen a survivor reach out to them for help. And sometimes the first question that civilian might ask that survivor is, well, have you gone to ask for help on the base? Or have you gone to ask for help from the VA, the Veterans Affairs? And that can be extremely difficult to hear. It can be really minimizing of that survivor's experience. And there's usually a reason why that survivor is coming to you rather than going to either a military or on-base installation service or agency, or going to the Veterans Affairs. Maybe they've already tried. Maybe they don't want to. Or maybe because from my experience, when you're a survivor, you really feel like you're going against the entire Department of Defense or maybe the entire service branch that you're in. And that's difficult. And to reach out to that same agency for help can be overwhelming and exhausting. And you've already feel let down if you've experienced any form of military-connected trauma, right? And so civilians, why do they need to understand this concept of military being recognized as its own culture, especially on a campus? Is because there's still this mindset that there's enough military programs or services that are out there for military connected individuals. And as Ava said, there have been great strides and great developments in a lot of different programs and services and agencies. However, what that can also do is the harmful aspect of that is as those programs are developing, there's that it's contributing to that mindset that there's already enough, or, oh, well, you're military connected, so you can go get help from them. And that can cause civilian advocates or campus officials or campus programs or civilian programs to turn away that survivor or not really validate that survivor's experience and recognize them as a survivor. But also another piece that they need to, another reason that they need to understand the military as its own culture and that the aspects of the culture is they need to work together. We can't continue to operate in silos. We see that operating in silos is not effective, whether it's in prevention or response. And we need these community agencies to partner with these military agencies and vice versa, because there are restrictions or there are limitations to what these agencies or organizations can do on both sides. But when those gaps aren't filled, ultimately the one who ends up with more harm is that survivor or their family member. And so civilians just need to do their best to recognize, and that's what our project really does. We really want to make sure that civilians recognize, and that's why we're so passionate and get fired up about it, is recognizing that we're human too. And yes, we're military connected, but we're still survivors. And we may be coming to you for help. And even if we're not coming to you for help, we don't want to be put off to the side, because it could almost feel like we're being ostracized or we're not being prioritized. And that can just continue to exacerbate the problems that we may be experiencing.
Thank you for that, Kim. And I think that these tangents, these rants are so important. I mean, I think all of our listeners can agree that whenever we're talking about things that need to benefit our community, things that need to be created for the betterment of the communities that we're a part of, I think all of us in this space and those who are listening to this episode can relate to getting fired up about it and getting passionate about it, because we live these experiences or we have lived these experiences. And especially, you know, our listeners who work on college campuses, you know, you're coming into contact with students, with people who have experienced these things or who are a part of these communities. So they're going to be coming to you with that same passion. And so I'm very excited to really get into this conversation, because it's so important. And I think that whenever we're having conversations about cultures, it's so very easy for us to think about the things that we can see, like those physical aspects that I said earlier. So race, ethnicity, potentially gender expressions, all of those things that we are very familiar with hearing about that kind of count as different areas of culture. But the conversations around military connected folks, that's something that still gets kind of tense, I feel like, in those conversations, especially when we're talking about culture. And I know specifically when there's that racial piece that's added onto there. And I've had this conversation with you all offline, but talking about, you know, how can I recognize the military as a culture when it has, in some folks' experiences, aided in historical and generational trauma for people that look like me, people that look like you, right? So, Ava, I'm very excited for you to get into this. But before we get into talking about some of the intersectionality pieces of identity and military connected survivors, what are some unique dynamics and challenges faced by military connected student survivors of domestic violence, dating violence, sexual assault, and stalking? And I know that Kim touched on this a little bit, but I want you to go a little more in depth about what challenges might be faced by that community.
Thank you again. Great question and great points that Kim made. I'm so grateful for both of you in this space. So just even thinking about the term military connected student and survivors, I mean, just in that title alone, you can identify a few different intersecting identities that can increase challenges for this population. So one, you have the military connected person that could be an active duty, a veteran, a spouse or dependent, a National Guard or reservist. or someone that may have experienced domestic violence or an assault from an active duty service member, veteran, or reservist. So you have that military connected identity. You have the college student, and then you have the victim survivor. And not mentioned, could be included, like we just touched on, is belonging to the LGBTQI plus community, or a person of color, or living with disabilities, visible or not, maybe immigration status or socioeconomic status. So many others that we haven't touched on, but there's so many that could be wrapped up in these identities that increase the challenges and unique dynamics that they experience. So if you were to consider all of these different identities, you can also maybe begin to imagine all of the ways they may have experienced a type of trauma or victimization, or have experienced cultural or historical trauma that is ingrained and maybe via intergenerational trauma. And looking at all of that, and they're just trying to navigate their environment, maybe from the military transitioning into the campus, and they're living their world through this lens, through this identities. And to compound all of this, maybe you experience that victimization in the military or while as a student. Who are you going to talk to? Who are you going to trust enough between all of these systems that may only acknowledge or accept one part of that identity? So maybe you experience institutional betrayal through the military by not getting the support services. As Kim mentioned, maybe that's why they're now seeking services on campus or in the community. And you go to the campus or you go to the community, are they going to experience institutional betrayal again? So I pose those questions to everyone listening because I just really want you to consider all of these different dynamics and challenges that military-connected folks are often experiencing, and they often don't express it. So last year, our campus projects conducted listening sessions for military-connected students and survivors. And some of the key themes and challenges expressed that are so important for campuses to be aware of include challenges transitioning from the military environment to academia, or challenges of losing part of their identity after leaving the service. Also not being able to relate to other students due to their age or experiences. Also, some of the attendees experienced and expressed more marginalization, isolation, and alienation. Again, where certain identities were not welcomed. For example, some students that were part of the LGBTQIA plus community, they went to these spaces to find community, find connection, but they were anti-military, and so their veteran status was not welcome. Also, a lot of military associations, organizations, agencies often have trouble recognizing the LGBTQI plus community, which is so unfortunate because there is a large population within our military-connected folks. Also, some other challenges that were expressed were those living with disabilities, that required military-connected students to need special accommodations. However, that difficulty in expressing vulnerability and requesting support was challenging because of what we talked about earlier, right? That warrior mindset, that toughness, that not being able to show weakness. And also, one of the major themes that was brought out from these listening sessions was the lack of a military-supportive environment, spaces, and climate. So if you're on campus, ask yourself, how is your university portraying the military? What is the climate like? Is there any anti-military rhetoric or conversations? And how are the military portrayed in service centers, if at all? Also, what spaces, events, and resources are specifically available to this population, and how is outreach being done? So we're happy to make those listening session report or toolkit available if anyone is interested. But I think most importantly for campuses to be aware of is that this population has experienced the military environment. They are coming from a different mindset that often cannot just be turned off and on like a light switch. And they will have additional challenges transitioning from that one large institution to another. And how can your campuses support these intersecting identities, these compounding challenges and potential traumas and not add on to the institutional betrayal or the victimization. So I'm just going to leave those questions out there for you all.
I am so excited. This is so good. I'm just over here listening in awe because these connections that you're making, these questions that you're asking, we don't think to ask these questions about military connected students. And I'm going to go ahead and just be honest in this conversation. And y'all know that I've touched on this before, but I think it's important to bring this into this space as someone who is a part of a culturally specific community. One of the things that we've talked about offline is how it can be difficult to see military connected people as a culturally specific community because of what I said earlier about how, you know, the military may have aided in historical and generational trauma, right? I know for me, it's hard for me to not look at military and law enforcement police as synonymous. And I know that that is not correct, right? Like, they're not synonyms for each other. But even within law enforcement, like, there is a culture there, right? When you're not a part of that law enforcement lifestyle, the culture, the family, you know, things look a little bit differently. And there are these nuances that exist within the other intersecting communities, race, LGBTQIA+, folks with disabilities. And so I think that oftentimes practitioners might have a hard time being able to separate the two, right? And I think that unfortunately it leads to gaps being expanded and it leads to practitioners doing a disservice to military connected survivors in their most vulnerable times. And we just had a conversation in episode one about how we don't want to further harm people who are coming to us and utilizing the supportive resources that we have on campus to in some way heal themselves, in some way seek justice and make themselves whole again. We don't want to further perpetuate harm, but at the same time, we're talking about a community that has perpetuated harm. And so really kind of understanding what it means to reckon with that, what it means to understand that, just like we talk about, and I'll say specifically for me, because I love talking about Blackness, right? How Blackness exists on a spectrum and the things that happen within our community that cause harm to other Black folks, right? The same concept, that same framework can be applied to military connected people. And so I think it's very important for us to not only have this space to talk about institutional betrayal, but there's enough for us to also talk about betrayal from our own communities. And that's a piece that I feel like has kind of been highlighted in some of the things that you all have said. When you are a survivor, you have to navigate the systems that have been built within your community that are literally working against you and ostracizing you and further oppressing you within your community. And while that might ruffle some feathers, I'm going to be honest, that is not different than some of the same concepts and frameworks and systems within our own communities that are also culturally specific, that might be marginalized, that are also harming the people who are a part of those communities. And so I want to be very clear that, you know, we're not talking about this, the socialization of power and privilege and white supremacy and all of that. But what we are talking about is that intracultural connection, right? What is happening there? What is existing in that community that further perpetuates harm onto those that are a part of that community? I want us to sit with that for a little bit.
Thank you, Asia. And I appreciate you bringing up these very valid and real points with the similarities of military and law enforcement or other first responders because of the historical cultural trauma with these institutions, with these agencies. And something that I like to say when I do present on these topics is I can, as a proud veteran, support military-connected survivors and support our military service members. And also, I can acknowledge some of the historical trauma and damage that has been done to other cultures, other locations, through militarization, through colonization, and also even still some of the trauma that is being done to this day towards victim survivors and people of color and all those other marginalized groups that experience the military environment. And I think it's important for us to be able to sit with both difficult truths. And I just want to say I appreciate this space and for you having the curiosity and the humility to be even open to having these conversations. Oftentimes when Kim and I are discussing this topic, this population in the social justice space, it is often anti-military, and we can understand to a degree some of that. But what we ask for communities and civilians and non-military connected is to just have that curiosity, that humility and empathy for the individuals and human beings that are connected to this organization. And when we also present to military folks, we say the same thing. Come with curiosity to your CCR meetings, coordinated community response meetings. Collaborate with curiosity, humility, empathy, and see each other for human beings. I feel like there's so much us versus them that happens in these spaces of intersecting identities or social justice spaces where it's like, can we just sit and be with that individual in front of us? And that's what we are asking for all communities who are supporting victim survivors, regardless of who they're connected with, what their political affiliation, what ethnic group they belong to. Let's address and support that person in front of us. So again, just thank you for opening and saying those points.
There are a lot of gray areas. There are a lot of nuances. There are so many other things that need to be considered. And if we want to be more culturally responsive in our approaches to how we work with survivors of domestic violence, dating violence, sexual assault, and stalking, we have to consider these things. And it can't just be an us versus them. Something that I say in my presentations is that we have to get the ego out of the room, right? And I know it's hard, especially when you are someone who has a marginalized population, multiple marginalized population. You are bringing your lived experience into the way that you are supporting people. But at the same time, it's kind of like, okay, what do I need to do right now to help the person that is in front of me? And so when we're thinking about that help and support, Kim, what are some steps that universities and campuses can take to create a more inclusive and understanding environment to better support our military connected students?
That's a great question, because I think it can, again, going back to just being overwhelming when you're talking about just the military. A lot of times in the presentations and trainings that Ava and I do, we ask them what comes to mind when you hear the word military. That term alone can be a lot and overwhelming, and different perspectives, different ideas. And then you're talking about military connected survivors. And so now we're asking campuses, universities, communities to better support military connected survivors. The first question we're expecting to get is, well, where do we even start, right? And so what can universities or campuses do to create a more inclusive and understanding environment is just to look around. It is just to look at your environment. I speak about this a lot when it comes to individuals living with disabilities and trying to see things from their perspective, trying to communicate with them and bringing them to the table. And so the ways that you can do this, my first recommendation is that one of the easiest things that you can do is go into your offices, go into your spaces. What do you have up on the walls? What kind of materials do you have? What kind of emails do you send out that portray military individuals? Is it a poster of a man in the dark corner with alcohol bottles around him and, you know, with no, there's not a lot of light. He's got his head down and he, you know, puts off this mood of depression or possible thoughts of suicide. Is that what, you know, is that the poster that you have hanging up on your wall about the military or about veterans or military connected individuals? And you might think, well, how does that relate to survivors? Well, if you're already portraying like we're here to help you, you're kind of already putting that mindset, that victim mindset rather than that empowering survivor mindset into that environment and into the spaces that you're trying to work and where you're trying to support military connected survivors. So the first thing you can do is just stop and just look around your spaces, look around your campus. How do you portray certain holidays like Veterans Day? How do you portray, how do you celebrate military connected students? How do you celebrate military connected families? How do you recognize the different, you know, we just talked about the intersectionalities. How do you celebrate the different intersectionalities of military connected individuals? Right. We have a lot of military connected students who are coming from, you know, getting out of the military after 20 years and going to get their bachelor's degree. And then we have some that are ROTC and are straight from high school. So age is one thing, but ageism is very real, and being treated differently on a college campus, it shouldn't, your experience in the military shouldn't necessarily be minimized because, again, you're affiliated somehow with the military. So one is look around your spaces. How are you celebrating, or how are you portraying, or how are you identifying the military individuals, military populations in your spaces? The second is bring them to the table. When I say that, I always reference, I talk a lot of, again, about people living with disabilities. I speak about that. I love to be able to bring that conversation in. I am a woman with a service dog, and I have a service dog because of my military experience. And the first question I get asked is, were you in the military? The answer is yes. And the second is, well, were you in combat? Technically, yes, I was in combat. But my service dog is more actually because of the experience of sexual trauma and retaliation that I had experienced. And so I say that because we are kind of left out of the conversation when it comes to service members having service dogs. You have got to bring the right people to the table. So if you're a university or you are a campus and you have a board of directors, or you have a veteran resource center, or you don't have anything that's some sort of committee or board focused on supporting military students, who's sitting at that table? Are there military connected students sitting at that table? And if there are they diverse? What's the demographics of those individuals sitting at that table? Are you letting their voices be heard? Are you letting them share their perspective? And what's the intent? What's the purpose of having that committee or having that board or having that group or that coalition possibly? If there is maybe a student-led organization, is that university or is that campus supporting them? You have to consider who is sitting at the table where, one, decisions are being made, and two, military-connected students and ultimately survivors are being supported. So we have a toolkit, and I know Ava mentioned the toolkits, and I'm sure Asia, you'll have that shared and readily available, recognizing what had come out of the listening sessions and how campuses and universities can use that toolkit to be more cognizant of military connected survivors. But the third thing that I'll say, what can universities and campuses do to create a more inclusive and understanding environment, is to celebrate and to recognize the military experiences from the military individuals themselves. I've spoken at different events where they want me to speak because I'm a women veteran. And that's fine. You know, great. Thank you. Thank you for letting me share a little bit of my story or my experience. But I've gone to events where there are some people who are leading this entire Veterans Day ceremony or this military appreciation day, and none of them ever served in the military. It's not that we're not appreciative of that, but again, you had led a project or a program or an activity, and you didn't include anyone with the military experience. And so to me, how that speaks to me and possibly other veterans, other military service members, active duty, spouses, reservist, guard, how that could speak to us is that we're not being prioritized. And if you're not prioritizing military connected individuals just primarily as being military affiliated, then we're definitely not going to feel prioritized as a military connected survivor. And we're not going to come to you for help. It's also key to remember, the last thing I'll share here is an example. I worked with a campus and a military base, and they were putting the students, a military training command wanted to have their students at the base put living on the college campus dorms because the base had run out of space for their dorms. And their solution was, oh, we have a great partnership with the university, which is awesome. That's great. They had a great partnership. They did a lot of activities and programs together. And their idea was like, oh, well, you have a huge open dorm building. Can we start housing our students there, the ones that have vehicles, and they can get themselves to base and go to class? Because, again, this was a training command. Well, my response to that was, first we need to have a conversation about Title IX. And we need to have a conversation about what support mechanisms are there. And that was not done at all. That was not considered. And so recognizing that, again, going back to those partnerships with community agencies and military agencies on the college campus, reporting for certain things like sexual assault, harassment, domestic violence is done much more different than it is in the military. And if that education and that collaboration piece isn't there, you could actually possibly be taking reporting options and rights away from military-connected individuals. And I know we're talking about survivors, but you could possibly be taking away those rights and those reporting options. And so campuses and universities can really help each other by providing that training and that understanding and connecting and collaborating and saying, okay, what are we going to do if this situation arises? Who are we going to call? And that's what we had to do. And we had to tell, I was very adamant about telling those students that we're going to be living at the college campus. If something happens to you, if you contact anybody on that campus, you do not really have much reporting options. It will most likely be an open, unrestricted report, which means it will be investigated by law enforcement. And explaining that to them to make sure that they were aware. If there wasn't that collaboration, if I hadn't stepped in, it's possible that they would have continued on about their business and, again, not prioritized military-connected survivors or military-connected experiences when it comes to domestic violence or sexual assault. And so it's so important to become educated and to collaborate and to work together to ultimately not just prevent, but really respond to military-connected survivors.
Kim, you said so much good stuff that I want to, you know, briefly touch on that I am currently, like, my wheels are turning because I'm thinking about my experiences on different college campuses. So I'm going to go back a little bit. That posters piece that you touched on, whenever I think about walking into a room and I see a poster dedicated to military-connected folks, I knew exactly what poster you were describing, where it's the military connected person sitting in the corner and it's the dark page and they look sad, but also scary. It's usually a white identified male and they're just kind of like staring like at you. And then you have like all of the things, right? The depression, PTSD, alcoholism, substance abuse, suicide awareness. And it's like, whoa, like, okay. Like, and yes, these are, for lack of better phrasing, sobering things to think about, right? But when that's all that you have to offer on your campus when it comes to providing support for military connected students and specifically survivors, I'm personally not going to use that, right? Because I'm like, so do you think I'm just like, do we have one idea of what a military connected student or survivor looks like? And if that is the picture and I don't represent that, how are you going to be able to adequately support me, right? And I think about seeing that poster not only as a student in college and as a staff member of a university, but also as a child, right? There's a sense of, I don't want to say command. What's the word I'm thinking about? It's like this sense of like, you know, oh my gosh, this is an important person, right? They're coming in their uniform, but it's also this idea of, oh, you're kind of scary too. Like, and when you think of someone who's commanding or scary, or, you know, they have this hard, tough job of protecting people, they can't be harmed because they are the protector. And we take that with us subconsciously when someone who's a part of that community comes to us and say, hey, I need to be protected in a sense. I need to talk through what are my options here? What are the resources? How can you help me understand the formal Title IX reporting process? Are there any community organizations that can help advocate for me outside of the support that I'm seeking on campus, right? If we have those concepts subconsciously in our mind about military-connected folks, it's going to continue to widen the gap in how we support them. And so we don't often connect these things. So I really appreciate you, Kim, for bringing that up. And also the piece that I often talk about, whether it's in my presentations with our grantee schools or just in technical assistance requests, bringing people to the table, bringing the right people to the table, amen, okay? But also, if you're bringing these folks to the table, do they feel comfortable in their seat at the table? Do they feel comfortable being able to be open, transparent, and honest with everyone that's at the table about how folks interact with them on campus, on how they see or they do not see their culture being highlighted, more education on their culture, more awareness of the cultural nuances that they experience? And by they, I mean military-connected folks. Like, if you can bring me to the table and have a seat for me all I want to, but that doesn't mean I'm going to say anything. That doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to feel comfortable to be open and transparent about my experience. And so I think that is so important. And I think it always goes into what I always say, like, you cannot do work for us without us, right? And that is something that is so very important when we're thinking about our culturally specific populations. And noting that there's a fine line between ensuring we aren't tokenizing these folks because we don't have a lot of information, or you might be in an area surrounded by civilians and you're the only person, you know, how do we manage that feeling of tokenization of the one military connected person we brought to the table, but also ensuring that they're included? And there's a lot of additional work that comes with that. And, you know, another thing I always tell folks is to give yourself grace as you're learning these things, because it can be overwhelming. And so I'm very excited to hear you all kind of close this out with talking about the OVW Military Project and how our listeners can get involved and receive support from this project, and how we can just better support military-connected student survivors. So go ahead and give us a little bit of information about that.
Yes, thank you. So our project, I'm glad that you kind of summarized my last points. Thank you for doing that. So I want to say thank you for that. And thank you for recognizing and validating a lot of what we're saying here, because Ava and I, we do manage, you know, a project that we're about to discuss, and we manage it for these specific reasons that we're talking about today. The project that we manage is funded by the Department of Justice Office on Violence Against Women. And the project is titled Advocating for Military Connected Survivors. And we strive to provide trauma-informed, survivor-centered, and culturally responsive training and technical assistance that empowers legal personnel, victim advocates, and allied professionals to support, again, the military-connected survivors who have experienced this domestic violence and dating violence and sexual assault and stalking. And we've talked about what is a military-connected survivor, and how can they get, you know, how are they identified as that? But it's important to recognize that we've found that when we say military connected survivor, a lot of times there's a mindset because of, again, what you just talked about, being warriors, and Ava mentioned earlier, being warriors, and us, oh, we can't be harmed, we're out there protecting people. So when we say military connected survivors, we have found that people, I think, immediately go to, oh, a survivor of combat or a surviving family member of a military service member. And that's not the case. And when we're talking about those military connected survivors in our project, our mission isn't necessarily to connect with DOD, Department of Defense personnel, or, you know, active duty service members, or maybe even reservists or guard. But it's intended to connect with these community advocates, community attorneys, civilian legal personnel, community advocates, campus populations, of course, like yourself, other allied professionals, victim advocates, domestic violence shelters, sexual assault resource centers. These different community agencies and organizations and advocates, because if you're working with survivors of violence, you are going to come across someone who is somehow connected to the military. And we can't guarantee that that person is a military connected survivor of domestic violence or dating violence, sexual assault, or stalking. But because of the rates of this in the military, it's likely that if you're working in this field, you are going to come across someone who is a military connected survivor. And so what our project does is we provide training, we do webinars, and we do, of course, podcasts now, like Look at Us Go, we're stepping up in the media world, podcasts and webinars. We do trainings, we develop toolkits, we recently completed a panel, we also did a lethality review with the state of New York organization. And a lot of the toolkits that we have developed and that we're going to continue to develop are, in a way, tip sheets or guides. One of the ones that we've recently released that I'm really excited about is our organizational self-assessment. And so it's kind of like, where do we start when supporting a military-connected survivor? And my approach, the way that I'm kind of asking organizations, including those that are in my local area, because we have a large military population here, I asked them, how prepared are you to serve a military-connected survivor? And if you look at me and you don't even know what I'm talking about, well, that kind of gives me, you know, indication number one. But two, if you're like, well, I don't know, like, that's a good question. How prepared is my team to serve a military-connected survivor? This organizational self-assessment is a tool to assess your readiness and your strengths and your areas of improvement in serving a military-connected survivor. So you can identify what the gaps are in your organization, and you can come back to us and say, hey, we did the self-assessment. We recognize, we know all the acronyms in the military, but we actually really don't understand what to do if someone is living on base housing and how to help them, or we don't really know how to communicate with law enforcement. So it can provide some different tools and direction that you can go to get started in better serving military connected survivors. And that's what we really want to do. I'm going to turn it over to Ava so she can provide some input on our project as well.
Thank you so much, Kim. And yes, we are just very excited and passionate about this project. If you can't tell from listening to us, then set up a virtual meeting, an individual consultation. We will do what it takes to make sure your agency, your campus is really prepared. We also partner with some amazing organizations, such as the National Crime Victim Law Institute, to assess with any legal questions or support. Soteria Solutions, which partnered with us to do that organizational self-assessment that Kim spoke to, and many others. So even if we're not the best point of contact, we will connect you to those who are. So everyone can reach out to us. Please email us at militaryTTA@trinova.org. You can also find our contact information on NOVA's website, which is trinova.org. And with that, we just want to say thank you so much to you, Asia, and for everyone listening and taking the time. Please reach out to us.
Thank y'all so much. I am so excited that we had today's conversation. I think it's very fruitful, and I'm very excited for the three of us to continue doing work around why it is so important for us to make sure that we are including our military connected students as a culturally specific community. And so this concludes another episode of the Centered on Campus podcast. We hope that you found our exploration of today's topic impactful and thought-provoking. And so remember that the journey does not end here. We encourage you to continue this conversation with your own campus communities. Please do your part in advocating and elevating culturally responsive approaches to preventing, responding, and supporting survivors of domestic violence, dating violence, sexual assault, and stalking. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or suggestions, please send them over to campusta@trinova.org. This is Asia Evans with Nova signing off. And remember, please take care of yourself and others. This project is supported by grant number 15JOVW-23-GK-05123-CAMP and is awarded by the Office on Violence Against Women, U.S. Department of Justice. Points of view shared in this podcast are those of the hosts and the partners and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice. Thank you for listening.